And now we are live! Yay! Friday Night Feel! Yay! And today, for everyone who's watching, shockingly, I have had the worst internet connection, so I apologize if that happens. If we lose each other, don't worry, I will come back to you. So welcome, welcome everyone to Friday Night Feels. I'm licensed mental health counselor, Patrick Manette, and tonight I have an amazing colleague, friend, and mental health expert that's joining me tonight. Welcome, Lee Diotalevi. Did I say that correctly? We just went over that.
It's Diotalevi.
Diotalevi. You know, when you get anxiety, it just like pops in your head. So Diotalevi.
Yeah.
Bravo, bravo, Cella.
We just say Dio. Lee Dio, that works.
So Lee, you are located in the beautiful state of South Carolina, correct?
Yes.
And you are, what I put on the advertisement is, even though I know you and I have talked about it, you specialize in trauma, you're trained in EMDR, you have amazing experiences with different therapeutic approaches, but one of your niches is really working in with adoption-related issues within the mental health field. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that sounds great. That's perfect.
Okay. How is everything in the South these days?
Well, it was cold and rainy all day, but other than that, it's kind of in the area where we are, everything kind of moves a little bit slow, and it's beautiful, and yeah, we enjoy it here.
Do you want some snow?
No, I had some snow. I did 18 years in Connecticut, so.
Oh, right.
Yeah, pull up for snow.
You have a lifetime's worth of memories of the white stuff.
I do.
That's so, well, once again, like, I'm so excited you're here. And before we started, Lee and I were just talking about, you know, different components of the mental health field. And, you know, adoption is such an interesting, I was thinking about this earlier, in my graduate work, I don't know if we ever had a conversation about adoption at, you know, to help us prepare clinically. When you were in grad school or when you were studying, did you have a specialization in that? Or was this something that you focused on once you got into the field?
Yeah, so I never had anything in grad school that taught us about adoption, even a little bit. But like most people, when I got out of grad school, I started working at the Department of Mental Health, and you get whoever's in front of you. And we had large caseloads. And after a while, I was just noticing, wait a second, all of these kids are adopted and they're kind of having the same, you know, symptoms, behaviors, relationship issues. And I was really just curious, and I reached out to some colleagues and started really trying to understand more about adopted kids at first.
Okay.
And that led me down the road to further trainings. There's a training I think I gave you a link to that's like 40 hours of adoption training. And it's a lot. It's a big endeavor. It's free CEUs.
Wow. Yes, you did send me that, and I can post it after when I post the video of tonight's show.
Yeah, super great training.
And isn't that interesting that neither of us had really any, because I was just thinking of how common adoption is, and maybe not even specifically adoption, but fostering, being foster parents, being in the foster system. Like, I feel like it's a whole onion of other issues and specialty of in the mental health field of what you would be seeing as a clinician.
It is. And, you know, we're not, you know, even like when I look at the assessment that comes with the software that we use at our practice, it doesn't even specifically ask about adoption.
Right.
So, you may see someone, and if you don't make a point to ask and do a really great adoption competent assessment, you don't even know necessarily that you're dealing with someone who is either adopted or is a foster child or is a first mother, a birth mother who had to make a plan for adoption for her child, or even, you know, even birth
the
fathers.
Father. Yep.
Yeah, they have struggles. In fact, there's a book I was just starting to read about a father's tale about someone who really struggled in relationships after having to make a plan for adoption for his child.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, maybe if we just kind of backtracked a little bit, how does How does this fit into your therapeutic practice now of focusing on the adoption piece? Because as you said, when I worked in a clinic, we might have had a question or two. Were you adopted? Were you ever in the foster care system? And then everything gets lost on the presenting issue.
Right. And that's a good way to bring it up, because what happens is usually parents bring kids in because they see behaviors that they don't like.
Okay.
And often, parents aren't necessarily prepared for some of the mental health issues of adopted children. So they're coming in, they want us to fix the behavior. Mm. And, as trauma therapists, when someone comes in and says, here's the behavior, we say, okay, so that's a symptom. What are we looking at? Mm-hmm. And whether it's an adopted child or even an adoptive parent or a birth parent, everything starts from a point of grief and loss. Mm, so you and I were talking about implicit memories and early childhood trauma and yes. even trauma in utero. And what happens is that these kids are attached to their birth mother before they're even born.
Right.
And no matter when that separation takes place, whether it's in the hospital right after you're born or when you're 7 or 8 years old, there's grief and loss that go with that. And I think that's hard for us to recognize, because in young kids, it comes out as anger and disobedience and maybe, physical violence against siblings. But at the core of pretty much everybody involved in the adoption triad is grief and loss.
Wow. That makes perfect sense. I never would have put it together until you said that, because whatever the reason is of an adoption, even if it's in the healthiest or the smoothest possible outcome, there's still grief.
Yeah,
there's still
grieving.
That loss. Yeah.
There's a great book called Primal Wound, and they tell a story about a mom who's with her child and the child is crying. And the mom intuitively knows that this 2-year-old misses the first mother.
Oh, wow.
And says that, you miss her, don't you? And he says, yes. And I've had other parents tell me that their child looked at him at 3 years old and said, where's my real mom?
Wow.
So they innately know.
Right, that connection. So when you have a new client coming in or an intake, how do you know which path to go with that discussion? If their lives have been affected by foster care or the adoptions process?
So realistically speaking, we have to get through our basic intake, right? so we get that information, we table it for a second, we go through and we do our whole intake. And often it will be the next session that we would do a more complete adoption competent assessment, where we would ask, the ages, the circumstances, maybe how many foster home placements they were in, mm-hmm. Whether or not they, they may have been with their first parents for 2 or 3 years. So we need to know all the details of that, what the relationship is like with their adoptive parents. And, most importantly, siblings are a big deal in adoption. And if you have 2 siblings that go to separate adoptive homes, that's not nearly as good as if all the siblings go together.
Okay.
Because
okay.
then they're missing their siblings. And, the sibling relationship is so close, and they also, have the opportunity to have somebody who looks like them. Mm-hmm. They're around the dinner table looking around their adopted family, and maybe nobody looks like them, or maybe it's a transracial adoption and they don't have the luxury of everyone in their community and their school knowing that they're adopted. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things to consider, but it's really helpful if siblings can stay together.
Right. But sometimes that's beyond anyone's control, correct?
I think most agencies and things know that is one of the higher goals. Obviously,
okay.
we need to get kids with safe parents. But I think that's, they really do push for siblings to stay together, it seems.
Okay. And so when you have people come in, for example, if it's a parent, the adopted parent saying, please fix this, you know, which we know a lot of times when someone comes in, or, you know, I do a lot of couples therapy. It's like, fix him or fix her. It's like, all right, well, that's not really what it's about, but we'll get there. You know, that's a lot to juggle. I can only imagine therapeutically, where you're trying to build that relationship with the parents as the clinician, but then you're also trying to figure out what's happening with this child or this young adult that, you know, as you said, there's the behavior, but then there's pain, right? There's a wound.
Right. There's a wound. And in the, you have to remember that the adoptive parents usually have a wound too. Oftentimes, and not always, but oftentimes they've struggled with infertility, maybe miscarriage, you know, a lot of expense and a lot of sadness. And so we have to remember that they usually come into this position after grief and loss as well. But, you know, we kind of need to drag them in. And I'll call parents and I'll say, okay, it's time to come to the principal's office. And they're like, okay, you know, they know.
Yeah.
You know, and they'll come in and be able to freely express themselves, because, you know, it can be frustrating. Mm-hmm. Can be frustrating. So we want to give them, you know, space to feel what they feel, and then try to figure out what's best for the family to move forward. And, you know, sometimes that can even be inpatient treatment. Adopted and foster children are more likely to have to spend some time inpatient.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How long does that usually last for?
So that's interesting. Depends on how stubborn the child is sometimes and how deep the hurts. But it can last up to 6 months.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I never heard of that. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's good to know.
It's usually more like three, but I've seen them do six. Yeah.
Now, what are some of the common presenting issues that you might see in an adoption-related case?
So I wrote down all of the diagnoses that we see.
Okay. You're so efficient. I love it.
I was talking with a colleague about this the other day about a diagnosis. And we said, okay, let's dial that back and let's make it look like this. That's what it really is, right? It's really trauma.
Yes. Yes.
But we see PTSD and ADHD and generalized anxiety disorder, and of course, major depressive disorder, conduct disorders, oppositional defiant disorder, attachment disorder, borderline personality disorder. So we have all of that. And because we have behaviors and we have trauma. And it was so great to listen to you interview Tasha last week. She said it. She said, you know, there I was at school and you were telling me I had ADHD. In the meantime, I was experiencing trauma at home.
Right.
So most of these kids do get an ADHD diagnosis. And many of them are on medication for that. That does seem to help, even though organically it's trauma.
Right, right.
So we do see, you know, that some kids are a little dissociative. So usually we do at least a screening for dissociation, if not a whole MID for dissociation, when we notice anything like that.
Okay. And then what's an MID? Just for people who may not know.
Multidimensional inventory of dissociation.
Okay. It's like an oral exam. I have to say your name correct by the end of the show.
I have to do that. And let me see how many acronyms I can use in one sitting.
I love it. Yes. Well, I was doing a show once and someone said, can you explain this for non-
this awesome picture.
Yeah, I had someone say, can you please explain this for non-clinicians? I'm like, right, right.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I see, you know, we see like, you know, we see on one end of the spectrum, you know, you may have siblings where one is extremely hypervigilant and the other one dissociates. Mm-hmm. So is way more disconnected. And then, you know, the lack of concentration is what usually gets them the ADHD diagnosis. And the depression comes from that original grief and loss.
Right.
And the conduct is just not knowing how to express the pain.
Right.
And the, you know, the borderline personality disorder, some of the interpersonal stuff that goes on, because they are afraid of rejection. Mm-hmm. And they don't, you know, interact necessarily in a healthy way because they don't really trust people necessarily, depending on what they've gone through.
Have you seen, I mean, I know we're talking about diagnosis and treatment. What about the other side of the spectrum where the child is healthy and balanced? Like, I mean, is there a larger proportion in your experience or percentage that if there's an adoption involved, there's going to be more mental health?
100%, yes.
Okay, so there's a higher risk.
Well, yeah, there's more adverse childhood experiences.
Okay.
So that's going to lead to more need for mental health treatment. But the good thing is that, you know, hopefully parents know that. And, you know, what kid doesn't need some kind of counseling or therapy? So we just kind of know they're on track to have that.
Right. Now, when, you know, because we know that adoptions can happen at any age, really, up until, you know, 18. What is the, and this might vary state by state, what is the process that parents get involved? Because I know that in our area, you know, if you want to be a foster parent, there's a very specific training that you have to go through. And I'm assuming that to become adoptive, you have to go through some sort of other training. But I've actually never asked that before.
You know what? And since we don't work on that end, I don't exactly know. I do know that usually there's some kind of DSS screening and they do a home study.
Oh, okay.
But often if it's what we call a kinship adoption, which we're seeing more and more because of the opiate crisis.
Okay.
So what you'll see is you'll see parents who are struggling with addiction, and then a grandparent's going to come in. And I don't know that they require much training for that.
Okay.
Because
it's almost kind of like survival, like, you know, this is really a crisis moment.
Right. And they usually prefer to keep kids with families.
Okay.
And then that creates sometimes, you know, its own problem where the loyalty is from the grandparents, and they lose their role as grandparents because now they're having to be parents.
Right. So they can't really spoil the kid or the child, you know, that they, you know, not all spoil, but enjoy that, because then the responsibility of raising a child is on their shoulders, which I, even though there's incredible love in those cases, that's got to be hard to see, because how would you not have some sort of resentment even to the situation as a grandparent?
No, absolutely. As a person who is about a year away from being an empty nester, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, you can see where an infant might mess with the plans, right? Yeah. So we would all have to adjust, right. And you know, and parents and, you know, grandparents do. But it is more difficult. They're a little bit older. They don't necessarily have the energy, and now they have a child who is their parent. So it is a little bit dicey.
Right. You know, as I was getting ready for tonight, I was just sort of thinking about different situations in my own life of people I've known who were adopted or have been in foster care. And it was funny, you forget about things, but I remember I had a classmate of mine who she and her three siblings were all adopted. And it was interesting because everybody knew about it. Like, it was out in the open. Everyone knew, the family made it well known, you know, and everyone was supported. But then I see situations where the adopted parents don't tell the kids that they're adopted. You know, for a plethora of reasons, and the destruction that can cause. What do you have a preference of, or is there a process, a preferred process of how to share your child that they're adopted?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we always want to go with age appropriate honesty.
Okay.
And even, you know, I've even had adopted kids say, you know, everyone has a right to their story.
Right.
It's their story. And, you know, historically laws have always protected the birth parent.
Okay.
And so now, you know, what we try to do, you know, sometimes the birth parents have passed away. There's a time when it's okay to tell that. But the thing is to not sit kids down and have that one discussion that says you're adopted. Mm-hmm. This needs to be something that we openly discuss, and that we know there's going to be questions. And just because the child doesn't bring it up, the parent needs to say, hey, why don't we talk about, you know, and see how they're feeling, check in as they get older, things change. Maybe someone at school said something negative about an adopted peer, or so it really needs to be an ongoing conversation.
Right.
And the truth that they can handle. You know, if your biological parent is incarcerated, you know, you may not find that out at 4, mm-hmm. but you may find out a light version of that at 8 or 9, mm-hmm. and then more details later.
Right. So I like that age appropriate conversations.
So, and you know, it's their story, and it's not anyone's job to protect any of the grownups when we need to make sure that the kid gets what they need. Mm-hmm. So if we keep it child-centered, I think we usually make really good decisions.
Have you seen in your experience the reasoning why parents wouldn't tell the adopted child? Is that out of fear?
Well, I absolutely believe it's out of fear. They maybe think that the child's loyalty will then go elsewhere. Okay. Sometimes they think it's not healthy for the child to find out, but you know, kids innately know. So it's interesting. Like I'm doing this, this year-long training, on adoption. It's like 8 hours a month. And wow. They play these videos of these people who found out they were adopted when they were 30.
And it's gotta just blow their minds. Yeah. Well, I think,
to be honest, like as a parent,
sorry, go ahead.
But I think, you know, as a parent, I just think that sometimes the adoptive parents feel threatened by the existence of the birth parent. Like they may show up at the door or harm the child, or they're kind of ever present right. in everybody's mind.
And it's interesting because I, like in the 90s, you know, when Lifetime movies were so intense, you know, like, you know, it was kind of like put into, it's like, oh my gosh, the birth parents are always these evil villains. And it's, I love what you just said of the children have a right to know. And I think it goes back to any parenting of you teach them right and wrong. You teach them healthy and unhealthy. And I think, you know, I've seen it where adults who I've worked with who have been adopted, you know, they have enough love for everyone.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, like, I can love you all. Like, I don't have to choose.
No, and you certainly don't need it to be chosen for you.
Right.
Who you know and who you don't. And these days, you know, with the internet and Facebook and Ancestry. Well,
yes, I was just going to say that all those tests, you're going to find
out. Seen one of those work out like so great.
Really?
Like so great. Yes, like so great.
I'm just hoping that, like, if I ever did it, I'd have this long lost relative who was like, Patrick, we have a castle waiting.
Right. Of course it would be a castle, Patrick.
In Europe. It was Europe. Like, on the countryside with bread.
Awesome. Yeah.
And Lee, you would come, you know, we would do workshops and, I mean, EMDR all over the place.
Yeah, so I forgot where I was going with that. Oh, but one of the things that is really more prevalent these days is to have open adoption.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit difference between those different closed and open adoptions?
So there's closed adoptions, which is when the child doesn't have any contact with the birth parents or the birth family, where they're adopted and the doors kind of close.
Okay.
And then there's semi-open, where the adoptive parents may communicate with the biological parents, send pictures once a year in an update. Okay. So there's that. And then there's open adoption, which is super brave for adoptive parents, super brave. And then what happens is they have kind of like scheduled time with the child, visitation, as long as it's safe. And the child's allowed to spend time with their biological parent, but their day in, day out parent and the decision making is the adoptive parents.
Okay. Now, all of that is decided by the judge in family court, or are there contributing factors from other parties?
So it depends on what kind of adoption. One of the ladies in our group runs her own adoption agency. So that's kind of, I believe it's finalized by the court.
Okay.
But those things are set up. And she was saying that even, you know, sometimes when you have parents that are struggling, birth parents that are struggling with addiction, that doesn't even necessarily shut the door.
Okay.
You know, it puts a pause on things. And once they get into a certain amount of recovery, they can reconnect, because ultimately those children, no matter what, long for that biological parent.
Right. Right.
Whether they admit it or not.
And then at age 18, everything changes, right?
At age 18, they start the search or show up at the doorstep because they've been searching since they were 14. Right?
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, you know, we try to look at how do we prepare kids for that.
Right.
And that takes a while, because the closer they get to 18, the more some of that trauma is coming back, and the more anxiety they're feeling. And then you have this, you know, anything that's pending is nerve-wracking, whether it's pending awesome or, you know, pending death. It's still the same situation where you're kind of in limbo and wondering how that parent is going to receive you.
Right.
So in a perfect world, we get to jump in there and do some sessions with the biological parent prior to the meeting.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that could be an option.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's amazing.
Super excited about that.
I bet. So if you, you know, had the platform to be able to educate, you know, a population about one or two components of this discussion, like what would you share, or what would you want people to better understand about the adoption process, or, you know, or mental health related issues?
Just that it's trauma. You have to have a really solid trauma therapy.
Okay.
And it's a moving target. There's something new each week, new and different. And I think that have you ever looked at developmental trauma disorder?
Are you quizzing me now?
No, I'm sorry.
I'm just kidding. I thought you were getting me back up to the MIT. No, I'm like, oh crap.
No, it's not even like a thing, right?
Can I Google it without her knowing?
No, they're trying to get that in the DSM-6 because it didn't pass the DSM-5. Okay. And it has every symptom that encompasses all those diagnoses we talked about. So the thing is just to realize that they're grieving, they're traumatized, and they're hurting.
Right.
And they have this connection, this heart connection with this person. And they don't know where they are, what they look like. So they're in a constant state of kind of yearning and wonder.
And loss, like you said, grieving of...
If they haven't shoved it down.
Right.
Because some folks can really shove that down, and then and then EMDR will bring that up.
You know? Right. And be able to treat it, hopefully, or at least help manage it better.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And, you know, as you're speaking, I can, you know, I've spoken to different populations before about trauma, especially I'm just thinking this one presentation where I was in, I was so honored to be asked to speak to like a school setting. So I had the administrators, I had the teachers, I had the nursing staff, I had everyone in a school system there. And I can just think of how important it would be for them to hear this message of, you might have a student, you might have a neighbor, you might, as a doctor, you might have a patient, you know, where this is an important piece of that child's story, whether it's whether they're doing well and they're adjusted and they're healthy, or whether there's some struggling there. I think that's, you know, that's a piece that most people may not even consider.
No, and I don't even think as mental health professionals, if we haven't been taught to look for it, I remember just saying, why am I seeing all of this?
Right.
And then looking at it through the lens of attachment and saying, okay, this is what's going on here.
And it's funny, I just had the conversation today about attachment theory. And if you're listening or watching to this and you've never, you know, researched it, it's a fascinating theory about, you know, our connection to our primary caregivers. And I remember in grad school, my experience was not good because, you know, there are all these different types of attachment. The golden one is a secure attachment. And most of us were like, well, we're not sure. And then the idea was, well, if you don't have a secure attachment, you're pretty much screwed for the rest of your, you know, that was like what we walked away with. And as young clinicians, right, not knowing, but now, you know, just like any injury, it may not go away, but you can definitely heal and adapt, but you have to acknowledge the injury is there.
Right. And not all adopted kids are ready to do that early on. And then we see sometimes where they're anxious to have their own children, because that's really the only way to get that particular attachment.
Right. And do you see, I'm just kind of going to jump to something else that popped into my head. I guess I'll backtrack, because I remember I was in talking to a professor many years ago who was open that he and his wife had adopted their two daughters. And when he spoke about his family, he spoke about his family like it wasn't, you know, these are my daughters, I'm proud of them, you know, it was just like anyone. And I remember the time where he told us that someone had said, oh, well, too bad, or they're not your real daughters. And even hearing the story took my breath away, because you just hear this man so proud of his family and loving his kids, and then someone to say, oh, that's not your real daughter.
Right. And kids hear that, you know, kids, especially, right. Like I said, if they're transcultural, transracial adoption, then it's clear to everybody that it's in all likelihood you're not biologically related.
Right.
And, you know, there are kids who get adopted a little bit older, they get a new name and they get to school and they can't pronounce it.
Wow.
And so, yeah, you know, when you get a new last name, sometimes it's a little bit difficult, and there's so many, everything's new, and, right. And the parents are different. And, so it's a lot to adjust to, and it's, you know, it's not like the old theory was, well, you should be grateful that someone is taking care of you.
Yes.
And it's like, no, say, you know, you're a child of God and you deserve to be taken care of.
Right. Preach.
You know?
Yes.
You know, it's not like you need to be grateful. That's what we all deserve.
Right.
So.
And forgetting that they're children.
Oh my gosh.
Like
they're children literally. Who were hurt, and
right.
Some of them, you know, severely abused.
I remember, so you know, that stuck with me of always just to be mindful, you know, okay, there's adopted. And sort of the way I approach it is very gentle of, is this an issue, you know, is this something we want to go into? And a lot of the people I will say that I've met in my experiences, it hasn't been problematic as much as in other cases. But I think having that question, and also I found the experience of whether or not they've been foster care, because that's a whole other barrel of monkeys. Some people, mm-hmm. And I don't know what your experiences are, some people have had amazing experiences in foster care, and some people, on top of losing their family, endure, that's when hell begins for them, is when they get into foster care.
Experience, it can be really rough because placements don't last, or they're separated from siblings, because usually there's some type of emergency placement and then another placement, and then they may or may not be adopted, and you know, sometimes there's a lot of children that come and go, so they kind of make a friend and then maybe they stay with the foster family, but then that other foster child goes back to their biological parents, so there's no consistency. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's why usually, as much as adopted kids maybe will balk, they really do thrive on structure, mm-hmm. and predictability. And but yeah, I think having the more foster placements you have, the more of a struggle you're going to have for the most right. part.
And a higher risk, I would imagine, of something traumatic happening.
Most definitely.
Because then, you know, I'm just guessing here, because then you're learning not to trust. You're learning, if I have to survive, I have to be secret. Like you said, you know, suppression, pushing it down, because it may not be safe.
Well, and that brings up a good point, because oftentimes if kids are neglected and maybe they're not fed, et cetera, we have a foster parent or an adoptive parent, and you'll say the kid is sneaking food. And that happens a lot because they're wired that they may not ever eat again.
Right.
Because that's what they were thinking at 2 and 3 when it had been a day since they had eaten.
Right.
So trying to figure out how to adapt to that, always leaving, you know, some nuts or a healthy snack out just to make sure they understand over time that food is available for them.
Yeah, and I love that. That suggestion of meeting the child where they're at, instead of letting the anger, the fear, and the frustration as the parent, which, I mean, we want to support them as well, because being a foster parent and being adoptive parent, to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, takes such an incredible amount of love and courage. Like, you're taking on this whole life and you're not even sure the whole story that comes with it.
And that's a good point. You don't necessarily know. So I think that, you know, along with empathy, a lot of humility.
Right.
When you're an adoptive parent, because you're going to have to, you know, go into the principal's office and find out what we would call a symptom, and the principal's going to call a behavior, is occurring at school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first thing other parents do is discuss what a terrible parent you are. Because look at what your child is doing. And it's really just all that hurt and trauma and maybe neglect that's coming out. So you have to be really strong sense of self.
Right. And also knowing when to reach out for help. And I think in the last, like, let's say decade, the stigma for parents to reach out for help hopefully is decreasing. Did I freeze?
No, I think you're right, though.
Okay.
It's definitely decreasing.
Yeah. I think school counselors are frontline workers, in my opinion. I, you know, at least in this area, the ones that I've had the privilege of knowing are trying to help these kids, in especially during COVID. You know, all kids, but then, you know, with other issues of how do we do this in school? How do we do this online? How do we support the parents, administration? Like, it's a whole other ball of wax.
Well, it is. And then if you're a kid who struggles to concentrate anyway, because you had trauma, it makes it more difficult. But back to what you said, yeah, I think it's the stigma. We have a huge waiting list here of folks. Right. And we have parents calling. They just want to get their kids some help.
Right.
And I see my daughter talking about how stylish it is to go to therapy.
Oh, hey. How
everybody has a therapist. And I was laughing, you know.
Did you record that? Did you record that?
No, wait, seriously. Wait. It's so funny.
You're saying mom's stylish, right? I mean, that's what I hear. I'm hearing.
Right. Mom's stylish because she's a therapist. Although I did have to hear the lecture the other day that nobody parts the hair on the side anymore. So I get the good and the bad.
Oh, my. Well, at least she's direct. She loves you.
No doubt.
See, I'm really good. I'm a good negotiator when I need to be.
You are.
Tell me a little bit more, maybe, you know, if you don't mind, what is it like in South Carolina? And with your business, you and I were just talking about it. So, you know, how do people find you in South Carolina?
Our website is Bluffton Okeechee Counseling, Bluffton Okeechee CC.com. Okay. And there's 7 of us.
Wow.
And everyone has a trauma therapy.
Love
and
it.
There's just brilliant women working in this office.
And for those who are interested, you know, even just to reach out, like they could contact you too, even if they're not in South Carolina. What I'll do is I'll post the name of it after when I post the video so that people can find you if they ever, you know, wanted to consult with you or reach out to you because you're doing such amazing work.
Well, thank you. And we're also looking to hire some online counselors as well as one in office. So if anyone is interested, you know, more people are moving to South Carolina, I think, than any other state in the union. So all y'all that are freezing up there, get licensed in South Carolina and come on down.
Hey, you know, what is the food like down there? Like, you know, I'm a foodie, like I'm a little too much of a foodie.
Okay, not that great.
Not that great.
Okay.
What's around there though?
Barbecue. I mean,
let's say there wasn't COVID.
Savannah.
Okay. I hear
good food in Savannah.
Okay. Georgia
Charleston.
Peaches, right?
Excellent.
Okay.
Hmm?
Georgia,
yes,
peaches,
Georgia
right?
Peaches.
Like I just
excellent said food in Charleston.
Oh, okay. Good to know. I'll put it on my list.
Come down, we have room.
Well, some of the people that I've been able to connect through that have also been on Friday Night Feels too, North Carolina has been represented. So the southern states, they're you know, I've never been to the South. Isn't that crazy?
It is crazy.
I don't know.
I mean, it's hot and humid down here in the summer, but the beaches are great.
There was a while ago when I was, many moons ago, when I was looking for different trainings, specifically EMDR, I always thought Dolly Parton is so cool. I think she's fun. She's an amazing advocate. I was like, wait a minute, I could do this training in Tennessee and go to Dollywood. Like, you know how you plan trainings around where you want to go, but it didn't work out. But maybe my introduction to the South needed to wait until we connected.
Yeah, you can come down here. We're right next to Hilton Head.
Ooh, that sounds amazing. Oh, my internet. Oh, someone, am I stable? Sorry, is my internet stable? Can you hear me okay? Whoops.
You're freezing up on me a bit.
Any bit. I don't know what to do. Like, I move around as if it does something. Hello? Hello? Is it better?
Now it is.
It's the oddest thing. Like, I keep moving. Like, I'm doing, like, I feel like, you know, the person at Bingo who has the lucky trolls. I'm like, if I move left and right, it'll change the internet, right? So, Heather Bea is saying hello. She's in South Carolina. So, you have someone in South Carolina watching. So, maybe the two of you will connect.
Yay, Heather.
Hey, Heather. Yeah, connect with her. And like I said, I'll post the information so people can get a hold of you, Lee. And then if people need services. So how has everything been with your world and in your practice with COVID? How is that changing? How do you manage all of that?
You know, so at first it was kind of a struggle because, it just kind of hit and all of a sudden you were like, okay, great. Now what do we do? So we ended up taking a little bit of time off and trying to navigate how we're going to do telehealth. And then when we were able to see all the insurance companies get on board with telehealth, and most importantly, Medicaid in our state is really important. And so when we were able to start doing that, everyone here just like worked really hard and adapted to trying to figure out the technology. And I tried to figure out the billing and we all kind of worked together separately, right, from home, figuring it out. And now we do see clients in the office with masks on.
Okay.
And we do a lot of stuff, and you were kind of like all office, and all of a sudden we were getting a lot of calls. I think people really stressed out being in the house with their family and not being able to go to work. You know, when you can't go to work, you don't really have kind of part of your identity, and families are really struggling.
Yeah. And I found that people were struggling and they wanted therapy.
We have a large retirement community here too. So that was
I'm sorry. Can you say that one more time? I froze.
So I think I was saying that we have a large retirement community here too, struggling as well. So it was really nice to be able to help them also.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. I found in some cases people, and I've talked to colleagues in this area, they finding that for some people, they wanted mental health services, but with the shutdown, they didn't have anywhere to go where they could even talk in private. And
that's a great point.
Right. And I think what I find is people are being more creative and more supportive of one another and family members of, I'm going to go in the garage. This is mom's time. This is dad's time. This is, you know, kids' time. It's safe. We're secure. We're going to go in the car. You know, here in the winter, we have limitations, you know, where people can go. But I think that there's more of accepting in a lot of cases, at least with my people. I think the way you just said it encompassed it perfectly. For me, when this happened, I think we were just in shock when the original shutdown happened. And for most of the people I know in therapy as practitioners, none of us were really doing anything with telehealth. It just didn't exist. So to transition for myself, my practice, my business online, like I'm still putting the pieces together, and you've been able to do it with yourself and your staff. And I just think that's so amazing and commendable. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, everyone just did a great job kind of on their own, you know, and then I struggled with like trying to figure out how to bill it all, and still right. do sometimes. But I think I laugh because I've seen a lot of people go to therapy from their car.
Yes.
It's nice
yes.
and private.
Yes.
We do have a lot of that.
Yep. And I have to say, I think.
I remember at first when.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I think at first when we were trying to figure out, and you know, the insurance and everything, we were like, okay, so what if they pulled up in their car and we sat in our car and then we could see them and then we would call them? And we were like, just trying to come up with like, how the heck are we going to help all these people when we're hamstrung? But yes. It all ended up working out.
Right. And I feel in New York, I mean, whatever the opinion is of, you know, not getting into politics, but I feel for the first time mental health was put in the spotlight in a positive way of having people with political power saying, everyone needs therapy. Like, let's support the therapist. Can we get frontline people? You know, there was a lot of movement there. And I think that helps battle the stigma because this is happening to all of us.
Right. And I think, you know, being in a red state, and I'm originally from California and then lived in Connecticut. So, mm-hmm. you know, blue and bluer, right. But living in a red state, I was really happy that our governor chose to allow us to see Medicaid clients via telehealth. And I didn't know that was
right. That's amazing. There's
a lot of restrictions on allowing him to have it, that he continues to allow us to do that post pandemic mm-hmm. because it really reaches a lot of people.
Well, yeah, and I think I hope that it opens the door because I'm just thinking of, you know, going back to family issues, one of the things that I'm thankful for is parents can have therapy and not have to worry about childcare or transportation or I mean, up here in the North Country, you know, snowstorms or, you know, different things like, or the babysitter showed up late. I don't have time, you know, if they have to drive 20 minutes. I think clients, even though I think we all miss seeing each other in offices, because it's just, it's that special connection. I think just knowing, oh, wow, I can still get therapy. I can still get support. And it's, it might be a little easier for some people.
Oh my gosh, 100%. You know, you and I have talked about me working on a book about how to best support, you know, people who have a co-parent who's a deadbeat, who doesn't pay and how, you know, the answer is, well, you need to do that. And right. Being able to sit at home on your phone while your child takes a nap or these days does their homework, right. You can get the support that you need for less money and less time and more convenient. And you know, if we have to, you know, leave our child with a babysitter, sometimes that's risky. You know, if we don't have a lot of money, then we don't necessarily can't necessarily afford to pay for those kind of things. And we want to be able to reach everyone who needs us.
Right. And even thinking about that with finances, transportation. I mean, in our city, the public transportation lacks. So if I have a parent who has one or two or three kids, that they can do therapy and not have to go on the bus or get a taxi or go out in the 20 below snow, you know, I think you can do better work. You know, everyone's safe. Everyone's healthy in those cases. And you can still support people in the community. I think it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, we don't have public transportation here either. And sometimes, like, if folks have Medicaid, they can get transportation, but then they're here an hour and a half before their appointment, and then maybe an hour after that. And you know, people can't really do that. So I think that telehealth has been a really big gift, and it's much nicer to be in the office. Mm-hmm. However, it's really great that it's allowed us to reach pretty much everybody.
Right. I've seen it where people, you know, just kind of going down a different path for a minute of if I'm working with someone who might be involved with a legal situation or probation or court, and they have to attend their services, they have to attend their counseling. I've had it's heartbreaking where they're all ready and then the Medicaid transportation just doesn't show up. And they are 45 minutes out of town or walking would take 3 hours to get to me. And now it's kind of nice of, oh, wait, we don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's weird. It's just, you know, I had the conversation with someone recently of I had to remind myself that COVID, for good or bad, really has broken everything.
And I
don't know why, like, I don't want to say it was denial, but I think sometimes you just put the nose to the grindstone of day in, day drive. And I think as self-care, as clinicians, we have to remember, wait a minute, this is happening to us too. And, you know, this affects our family, good or bad, or, you know, our self-care and our wellness and our ability to have fun and balance it all. Because one of the things too, like if we could go back to grad school, and one of the things that I'll tell students if I'm talking to them is I remember my professors talking about self-care, but I don't think they explained it well enough. Because when you're going into this field, you're doing it because you love people. Whatever specialty you're going in my belief, in human services, you're doing it because you want to serve people and help them. And I do it and I love it and I feel honored and humbled with all of the people that I meet in every way. But your heart hurts when you see adults or kiddos in pain. And as a mom, I can only imagine how you've really had to improve your self-care or increase it to trigger that mom gene when you're seeing kiddos in pain.
Most definitely. And that's why I'm glad we have such colleagues here, because I'll just go sit on someone's couch and say, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Some of it's really, really tough.
Right. And I had a job once where I was working with kids. It was kind of like a therapeutic big brother, big sister program. And it was just because the kids were just so amazing. Like, but once again, I was able to see their behaviors are the symptom. And it was so painful in certain circumstances, because you could only do limitation. You can't change a system if the system's not willing to change.
True enough, yeah.
And learning how to separate that of what was hard, because you have to build a whole other set of muscles. And so when I see people that specialize with kids and teenagers, I just have the utmost respect, because it's tough.
It's tough, but you know, we're lucky because we can balance it out, right? So we also have adults and we have seniors, and I mean, teenagers are great. There's so much there.
Yeah. And it's funny, because, I mean,
and you know,
sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking that, like, when we talk about telehealth and we talk about teenagers, you get so much more out of a teenager laying on their bed telling you the story. Like, it's fantastic. It's better than them in the office with a mask and a parent in the hallway.
Yes. I have to say, I specialize more in adults, as you know, but with the teenagers I've had, or even like kids of adult parents, they're like, you want to see the pet, or you want to see the plant, or you want to see our room. And it's this incredible pride that they get to show us, you know, this special part of their life that we never would get to see. I've met more amazing.
It sounds like a legal boundary violation.
We won't go there, Lee. We won't go there. It's all good. But it's so cool, because I think it helps their mental health. And I think it also helps us of that humanity of, hey, we're all going through this. Like, how can I just best help you? How can I help, you know, support you in any way? And we're all in this together. It's all different. I hate that saying. I want to be careful. What is that saying? It's like, we're not in the same boat. We're in the same storm.
Right. For sure.
Like, you know, we all have different things, but knowing that COVID's affecting all of us, and just how can we be there for each other?
Yeah. And I think we're seeing more and more of that in the last few weeks. So I'm really liking that people are getting more hopeful.
Right. So is there anything else before we wind down tonight that you would like us to know, you know, anything you're working on, or any bits of wisdom or any techniques or tips that we can help spread relating to mental health, adoption, trauma?
Well, I would just say that it's something new each day, and just to be really flexible and to understand that they're not necessarily that client you see once a week for an hour. They might be twice a week. They might be twice a week in a call for mom, and then a session with a parent. And so it requires a lot of flexibility, because it's just a really complex situation. So, you know, and you see them for years. I've adopted clients for years, because when I met them, they were at a different developmental stage than they are today. Right. So you really are really invested, I think.
Right. And the other piece too, that I'm one, you know, you and I have had these conversations of, in addition to what you're saying, is knowing when to reach out for support for yourself, but also for the client when you need, you know, do you need the pediatrician or the PCP? Do you need psychiatry? Do you need medical, you know, Absolutely. Do you need legal guidance on these situations? You know, because you and I've had conversations where, you know, I've just walked away knowing so much more about the legal component of these situations. So you're always learning. And you're always reaching out to colleagues in different ways.
Right. And we need them. We need them. And And they work with us really well around here in this area. So that's really great.
That's awesome.
So yeah, they're important.
Well, Lee, I am so thankful that you were able to come and join me on Friday Night Feels tonight. I hope it wasn't too painful. I'm sorry for any of the internet interruptions. I'll blame the snow. Whatever. I'm in outer space, Lee. Can you hear me now?
I'm in outer space. Thank you so much, Patrick. It's always good to spend time with you.
You too. And I hope you come back sometime on Friday Night Feels. It's, you know, you're welcome home now.
Thank you.
And for anyone else, just a reminder, if you're, well, actually now, on just a reminder that on February, sorry, geez Louise, end of the week, brain, January 31st from 12 to 4 Eastern Standard Time, we are doing the Beat the Winter Blues Wellness and Craft Fair online. And you can go to the website, you can go to my Facebook or my website, patrickmanette.com. You can also go to the website, which is Booth, B-O-O-T-H, Central. And if you go to that website, you can log in from anywhere. It's free to meet our vendors. I'm going to be doing live interviews. I have vendors coming from all over the different states to join. Just, you know, have some fun, beat the winter blues, and, you know, support small businesses. So I hope I can see you there. And I hope everyone has a beautiful weekend and stay safe out there. And Lee, I hope you have a great weekend.
You too, Patrick.
Thanks.